This evening we'll take the remainder of our time and turn back to the book of Leviticus. We're picking up in Leviticus chapter 25 this evening. We're almost through our study of this book, and I trust you've been encouraged by it. I've found it encouraging and challenging at the same time, so I at least have greatly enjoyed it, and I trust you have as well. We're just about to the end of this section that's called the Holiness Code. All these chapters from 17 all the way through chapter 26 are dealing with how the Israelites are to live as a holy nation, separate and distinct from all the people around them. And chapter 25 is coming toward the end of this. If you notice, if you've turned there already, the chapter begins, "The Lord then spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying," so that shows us a formula we've seen several times, "The Lord..." That reminds us that this is a new section. It indicates that we're moving into something new, that still within this covering idea of how they are to live, but some new information that God is giving. It's a little unique that this time we're told the location. That location underscores the authority of what we're about to see. These commandments were given directly from the mouth of God to his servant Moses on top of Mount Sinai, the same place where he received the book of the law, in that the Ten Commandments were carved on the tablets of stone, and God gave him all the information about how to build the tabernacle. As part of that, he received this information. Now, this chapter, I'm going to move fairly quickly through it because it's a large chapter, but yeah, I think we can wrap it up here this evening fairly quickly. But I just will mention that there's a couple different sections here that conclude with, "I am the Lord your God." There's actually three different sections that breaks into naturally by that phrase, "I am the Lord your God." When we come to that, that kind of wraps it up. We've seen that phrase numerous times in our study here through these sections of the Holiness Code. God as Yahweh, the covenant maker, the one who made the covenant with them, God himself has the right to determine how they ought to behave, how they ought to live. So when he says, "I am the Lord your God," that's really answering the question of, why should we do these things? And the answer is, because I am the Lord your God. That's all the answer they need. There's times when parents, our children, will ask us why. Why? And we answer, because I say so. The simple fact that I am the parent gives me sufficient authority to make a statement at this point, to set the rules, to delimit what is to be done and not done. Well, even to a much greater degree, that is the case with the Lord. Why should they live this way? Because God says so. No questions need be asked beyond that. So that's how we can figure out what this chapter, how it breaks down logically. The chapter itself is building on the idea that we came up with a couple chapters ago in chapter 23 about the Sabbath. One day out of every seven, the seventh day of the week, was to be a day of rest. Well, this is building on that idea. Now as we come into the idea of a Sabbath year and then a year of Jubilee that will be introduced. The phrase, "I am the Lord your God," actually shows up for the first time in verse 17. So that's really the end of the first section, but verses 18 through 22 still tack on. They're like an epilogue to the first section. They address an additional concern that the instructions that God would have given would have created in the minds of the people. So really the first 22 verses work together as one unit. It starts out with this idea of the Sabbath year. Let's read verses 2 through 7. "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, in 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its crops. But during the seventh year the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Your harvest after growth you shall not reap, and your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a Sabbath year. All that you shall have, all of you shall have the Sabbath products of the land for food, yourself and your male and your female slaves and your hired man and your foreign residents, those who live as aliens with you, even your cattle and the animals that are in your land shall have all its crops to eat." So we have this Sabbath year, and the idea is fairly simple. It's just that every 7 years, the land is to lie fallow. I grew up in a farming community where we were raising wheat, and there the standard practice at the time was every 4 years to leave the land fallow, to leave it sit for a year, because that allowed the ground to replenish its moisture content in North Dakota. Well, here the idea that God gives them is after 6 years of harvest, the seventh year is to be a fallow year. The land is not to be worked for crops. However, because they did not cultivate the land or do anything to the land this last year, the land would still produce. There would be leftover grain. That which grew after the harvest, some would come up after, was knocked out of the heads and various things would lie. That would come sprout up. The vines of the grapes would continue to grow. There'd be some wild produce, not cultured produce. But that would be out there in the land the seventh year. And God says the Israelites and their hired hands and their slaves and even their animals, everybody living in the land could eat that which grows naturally during the seventh year. They were not to work the land, but they could eat what grows up on its own. The idea was that this would be a land of rest, or a year of rest, rather. It's built on that weekly idea of the Sabbath, that after 6 days of working, the Israelites were to cease from their work, according to chapter 23, verse 2. Well, same thing here on a yearly standpoint for the land. After 6 years of working, the land gets to take a year off. The land could rest. In the end, this becomes that test of obedience, a test of faith. Would there be enough food? Would they have what's required to live? How can they endure a year without working the land? It's a test of their faith and a test of obedience when God tells them to do this. You know, it's one thing to set aside a day a week when you're tired already and say, I can work 6 days and take one day off. Take a whole year off from agriculture. That takes a lot of faith. But it's a year that they could rest, the land could rest, and they could focus on more religious activities. It became a tradition during this year that they would read the Pentateuch as part of their festivals. They'd read the entire book of the law. So there was a spiritual content to the year as well. Well, let's move on to verses 8 through 17, where we're introduced now to the idea of the year of Jubilee, that builds on this idea of the Sabbath year. Every seventh year, now in verse 8 says, you are also to count off seven Sabbaths of years for yourselves. Seven times 7 years, so count out 49 years, so that you have the time of the seventh Sabbath of years, namely 49 years. You shall then sound a ram's horn abroad on the 10th day of the seventh month. On the Day of Atonement, you shall sound a horn all through your land. This shall thus consecrate the 50th year and proclaim a release throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his own property, and each of you shall return to his family. You shall have the 50th year as a jubilee. You shall not sow, nor reap its aftergrowth, nor gather in from its untrimmed vines. For it is a jubilee, it shall be holy to you. You shall eat its crops out of the field. On this year of jubilee, each of you shall return to his own property. If you make a sale, moreover, to your friend or buy from your friend's hand, you shall not wrong one another. Corresponding to the number of years after the jubilee, you shall buy from your friend. He is to sell to you according to the number of years of crops. In proportion to the extent of the years, you shall increase its price. And in proportion to the fewness of the years, you shall diminish its price. For it is the number of crops he is selling to you. You shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. So the year of Jubilee, this is the 50th year. So count out 49 years, and on the 50th year will be a year of special celebration. They give specifically which day the ram's horn is to sound. The 10th day of the 7th month, that is the Day of Atonement. If you remember from our festival of calendars, which different calendar events they had throughout the annual year, on that 10th day of the 7th month was the Day of Atonement, that special, special holy day that they had where their sins were atoned for. On that day of the 50th year, every 50 years, there was to be this special celebration with the sounding of this ram horn. The trumpet blast proclaimed liberty to all the inhabitants of the land. That meant that everything that happened during the previous 49 years was basically erased and things are reset. If property had been sold, that property would be restored to its rightful owners. that indicated that ultimately the land was God's land. This land of Canaan that they were taking, God was the owner of the land. They were just tenants on the land. And God had assigned the tenants based on their families, who would have which land. And if something happened along the way where they had to sell their land because of hardships, they had to sell it to someone else to make ends meet, on the 50th year, God reset everything and said, now it goes back to the rightful owners that I've declared. This is a law then that protected the weak. Society has a natural tendency for some to rise and increase in wealth and put down those who are less fortunate and become impoverished and weaker and weaker. Well, this is a great equalizer. Every 50 years, the balances were reset, and things would start over once again. Notice, though, that this year of Jubilee was to be treated as a sabbatical year. The guidelines for it, this year of Jubilee, is to be treated as a Sabbath year. It is a Jubilee, it shall be holy to you. That means that the 49th year would be a Sabbath year, and then the 50th year is a Sabbath year. 2 years in a row, when this year of liberty comes along, they were not to work their fields. 2 years in a row, the land was to lay fallow. 2 years in a row, they were not to work their vineyards. The people could eat what could be taken naturally from the fields during these 2 years, but for 2 years in a row, they could not generate crops through their efforts. If you think the seventh year was a test of faith, this would be a severe test of faith. That God would provide for 2 years' worth of food without any effort on the part of the Israelites. Their faith was entirely in God's providence at this point. The guidelines from verse 13 onward basically is dealing with how the sale of property is to occur. The whole idea is because of this year of Jubilee, the property itself is not being sold. When the person who owned that property, sold it to someone else, they weren't really selling the property. They're only a tenant on that. God owns the property in the end. What they're selling is use of the land. They're selling a number of crops. So they had to base the price of their sale according to how many years of crops were remaining until the year of Jubilee, because that was the maximum amount of a benefit that the purchaser would receive from the land. As soon as the year of Jubilee arrived, the land would revert back to the original owner. So the whole idea in verses 13 and onward is that the Israelites are not to take advantage of their countrymen. They weren't to look at the fact that someone was in desperate straits and had to sell their land as an opportunity to get a better deal for themselves. They were to adjust the sale based on number of lands, and it was to be equitable at all times. And in verse 17, God says, "You shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God. For I am the Lord your God." The motivation for fair dealings was to be their fear of God. It wasn't be motivated out of necessarily compassion for their brother who was going through hardship. It was motivated out of fear of who it is that is overseeing the land, and that is God. Well, I said verses 18 through 22 actually are tacked on to this first section. The first section deals with this Jubilee year, sets out the guidelines for it. But the question that would naturally come up is, how in the world will we survive 2 years without growing crops? That's a natural question. You know, even I mentioned that where I grew up, we would basically make the land fallow every fourth year. But all the farmers then came up with a rotational system where we had crops on three-fourths of our land every year and only had one-fourth not being producing, and we'd rotate that around, so every year there was crops being produced. We never set all the land fallow at the same time, but that's what they're being asked to do. That's what God is telling the Israelites to do, set all of the land fallow. And on this year of Jubilee, do it 2 years in a row. The 49th year, which would be a Sabbath year, and the 50th year, which is the year of Jubilee. So the natural question that comes up is, how do we survive? And that's what God addresses in verse 18. He says, "You shall thus observe my statutes and keep my judgments, so as to carry them out, that you may live securely in the land. Then the land will yield its produce, so that you will eat your fill and live securely on it. But if you say, 'What are we going to eat on the seventh year, if we do not sow or gather in our crops?' then I will so order my blessing for you in the sixth year that will bring forth a crop for 3 years. When you're sowing the eighth year, you can still eat old things from the crop, eating the old until the ninth year when its crop comes in. So God gives a promise of provision here. God requires obedience of his people. He lays this out. This is my statutes. I require you to obey. And if you comply, if you obeyed, then you need not worry about what you will eat in the Sabbath year. The Lord will sustain. He promises to provide. And he will do that through a great provision of crops in the sixth year. God knows their heart. He knows in advance, clearly, if they will keep the Sabbath year. He knows if they're going to follow it. So he commits himself. If you will commit yourself to the seventh year, I commit to giving you the food to survive through that year. He is the great sustainer. And that's the lesson he tries to teach them here with these verses, with this promise. And the benefit, if they will trust him, is then that he will allow them to live securely in the land. They will have safety. They will have security. They will have everything that they would hope for when they take over this land. Remember, they're at Mount Sinai now. They've just left Egypt. This is early in the Exodus when they're at Sinai hearing this. And God's saying, when you get to the land, do this, and I will supply for you. Seems like a lesson that we struggle to learn even today. We look back on this and say, that's very simple, right? You just, every seventh year, you don't do anything and trust God. Shoot, I don't know, last time God asked me to go a whole year without doing anything, I have trouble trusting him when he tells me to trust him for the next 10 minutes. We still struggle with this, don't we? We know what God has said so many times. And we know that he has promised that if we will trust him, he will see us through it. But we still struggle to obey. They struggle to obey, too. The year of Jubilee was one of the most violated years. And when it comes time for them to be exiled, God makes a point that you're going to be exiled 70 years to make up for all the Sabbath years that were neglected. We don't know if they ever really executed the year of Jubilee. We know they executed a few sabbatical years, the seventh year. But they obviously skipped many of them because God says, you owe me 70 years. So I'm going to take you out of the land. The land's going to set fallow from your standpoint because you're out of the land for 70 years because you did not trust me. We need to learn to trust God. That's part of the benefit of these Old Testament lessons. God is still the same. He hasn't given us this requirement. We don't have land that we have to set fallow, but he's given us a lot of other things, and his answer when we ask this question about how will it work out, his answer is still the same. Trust me. I will see to it. If you follow my guidance, I will see to it. Why do you, God, have the right to give me these rules? Because I am the Lord your God. There's no other reason required. Well, let's move into the next section. The next section deals further. We're in the context now of this sabbatical year, and then beyond that, the year of Jubilee. Now we're going into how the year of Jubilee works. Verses 23 through 38 deal with how is property redeemed on this year of Jubilee. So we'll read all 23 through 38 at one time. The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. For you are but aliens and sojourners with me. Thus, for every piece of your property, you are to provide for the redemption of the land. If a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold. Or in case a man has no kinsman, but so recovers his means as to find sufficient for its redemption, then he shall calculate the years since its sale and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it, and so return his property. But if he has not found sufficient means to get it back for himself, then what he has sold shall remain in the hands of its purchaser until the year of Jubilee. But at the Jubilee it shall revert, and he may return to his property. Likewise, if a man sets a dwelling house in a walled city, then his redemption right remains valid until a full year from its sale. Its right of redemption lasts a full year. But if it is not bought back for him within the space of a full year, then the house as in the walled city, passes permanently to its purchaser throughout his generation. It does not revert in the Jubilee. The houses of the villages, however, which have no surrounding wall, shall be considered as open fields. They have redemption rights and revert in the Jubilee. As for the cities of the Levites have a permanent right of redemption for the houses of the cities which are their possession. What therefore belongs to the Levites may be redeemed, and a house sale in a city of this possession reverts in the Jubilee. For the houses of the cities of the Levites are their possession among the sons of Israel. But pasture fields of their cities shall not be sold, for that is their perpetual possession. Now in case a countryman of yours becomes poor, and his means with regard to you falter, then you are to sustain him like a stranger or sojourner, that he may live with you. Do not take usurious interest from him, but revere your God, that your countryman may live with you. You shall not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. So this section really is addressing how to evaluate the land's worth for a sale. And it's all based on this proximity to this year of Jubilee. How many years out is the year of Jubilee? But the theological statement that undergirds all of this legislation, everything that, God is saying here, is found there in verse 23. The reason God says this is because, for the land is mine. You're but aliens. You're just sojourners with me. The land is owned by God. They're just tenants of the land. And because it's his land, the land must be used according to his plan, consistent with his policy. So in verses 24 through 28, there's three different outcomes that could occur regarding the sale of property by an impoverished Israelite. The amount that the land is valued at, what the sale is worth, is based on current year to the year of Jubilee, how many years of crops are coming. And then once that land is sold, there's three possible outcomes. The land could be recovered by this person called the kinsman redeemer. We'll talk a little bit more about him in a moment. The land could be bought back by the one who sold it himself. Somehow he regains the earn. Or the land could revert during the year of Jubilee. If you think about it, the year of Jubilee comes every 50 years. That's basically once every lifetime. It's essentially a do-over point. You could mess up, get yourself in a really bad strait, but sometime during your life, there'd be a chance to start over. Even if you lose everything, somewhere within your life, there should come a point where you can start over and once again have your land to give to your children as inheritance. So the first option that could occur is that the land could be recovered by the kinsman redeemer. The kinsman redeemer was a close relative. And this person is actually under obligation to reclaim the land sold by an impoverished family member. The person had this obligation. If their family member had to sell their land, because they are family, because they're blood relatives, the kinsman redeemer, this kinsman is to take on the responsibility of redeeming the land when he had the means to do it. This kinsman redeemer becomes a major concept in the Old Testament. We won't have time to explore it tonight, but it all prefigures what Christ does for us. This right of redemption, this person had the responsibility to redeem a relative who finds himself enslaved. We'll see that in the next section. He has the responsibility to redeem land that was sold. He has the responsibility to carry out the role of the avenger of blood if a relative is killed in murder. This is the man who has the responsibility to seek justice. So the kinsman redeemer is a large concept. If you know the story of Ruth, you see it in action with Boaz. He's a kinsman redeemer for Ruth. So it has a large idea. But here specifically, this near relative has the responsibility. If a person has sold his land, this relative has to come buy that land back. This doesn't mean that he hands land back to the one who sold it. It means that it stays within the family. So basically, the land is now owned by a family member. It's his land until the year of Jubilee. It doesn't automatically revert back to the seller. Of course, if the kinsman redeemer buys land, it's his land. He could give it to his cousin or brother or whoever it was if he chooses to, but that's not his obligation. His obligation is to bring it back into the family trust. Now, the key in all of this is that he has this obligation, and the person who buys the land cannot refuse to have it redeemed. The buyer cannot reject the redemption if the kinsman redeemer comes, or if the one who sold land is able to somewhere along the way buy it back. He gets back on his feet. Whatever the hardship was that caused him to become impoverished, he's able to overcome, and he's able to come up with funds to buy his land back. The one who sells it cannot refuse to allow it to be redeemed. The right of redemption can't be refused. All that the one who bought the land can do is calculate a fair redemption price. And that redemption price presumably is simply based on the amount that the buyer received minus the amount that he had earned through crops by having the land. He had calculated a price based on number of years, X number of years. Some of those years have been used, so the price of land now is reduced by however many years have transpired. The value of the land simply decreases as it approaches the year of Jubilee. Verses 29 and following there deal with some exceptions. What do we do with these exception conditions? The first exception is a walled city, where you have houses in a walled city. And in a walled city, the transfer of property, God says, differs from that which is land itself or crops. There's no crops being produced by a house in a walled city. So in a walled city, the right of redemption only extends for a single year. The seller had 1 year to buy back the property before it becomes permanently the possession of the buyer or the buyer's descendants. There's no crops attached to the house, so there's no direct livelihood for the family that's at stake here. The house in the walled city is not permanently owned by a family. It's not part of God's allotment to a family. So once it's sold, there's a year of possibility for it to be redeemed, and after that, the sale becomes permanent. Houses in a village, by contrast, are treated like the sale of land. Apparently, they were considered to be part of the land. They went with each parcel of land. So if a house within a village without a wall was sold, the rules of land use apply to it, and they could always be redeemed, or they would revert back at the year of Jubilee. Then it comes up with the question about the Levites. If you remember, the Levites did not receive land. The Levites received cities, and they received pasture land around the cities, but the individual families of Levites did not receive land. So therefore, God says this law does not apply to the Levites. They always have the option to buy back their houses. If a Levite gets into a problem and he sells his house, he always has the right to buy it back. Levites also cannot sell any land of the pasture lands around the city because it wasn't owned by a single Levite. It was their shared possession as Levites. They had inherited personal lands, so that's why there's an exception for them. And in verse 35 and onward, the Israelites are simply admonished to be compassionate people. Aid those in need. Do not take interest from anyone in need. They're not to take advantage of needy brothers and sisters, relatives, fellow Israelites, those who are in need. They're not to sell them food for a profit. One commentator said they must be as generous to members of their own family who are in need as they would be to aliens. God had spelled out a lot of laws about how they were to care and provide for the aliens. Well, sometimes it's easier to be generous to a person we don't know than the one who is close to us. They're to be just as generous to one who is close family as they would be to a stranger. They're to treat them well. It's interesting, this whole idea of usury. Do not take usurious interest from them. They're not to receive interest from one who's in need. No loan sharking is allowed. And it's interesting that the prophet Ezekiel lists this among some of the most serious crimes. In Ezekiel 18, verses 11 and 13, again in 22, verse 12, he lists usury along with things like idolatry, adultery, robbery, bribery, and even murder. So Ezekiel classifies this seeking of interest from those who are relatives as just as severe as these other heinous acts of sin against other men and women. It makes a very serious thing, and God is making that point here. We should note that this is unique in the societies of that day. There's a lot known from history about other of the nations around Israel at this time. Israel's laws about this usury, about interest, they're unique. They are a people that had this law from God that the other nations did not have. They had laws about not being unjust loan sharks, basically, but they could charge interest. Israel was not allowed to, and the reason God gives, he gives them a theological reason. He says, do not do this because I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan. The Israelites are people who were freed from bondage by the hand of a merciful and gracious God. And by turn, then, they are to show mercy and grace to others. Well, again, there's that lesson still applies for us. We have been men and women who have received grace and mercy from the hand of a gracious and merciful God. So that obligates us to be men and women who show grace and mercy to others. The last part of the chapter here deals with redemption of people. Verse 23 and onward, what we just looked at was redemption of property. Now we have redemption of people. People could actually sell themselves into slavery. And God deals with that now in the last section. If a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you, you shall not subject him to a slave service. He shall be with you as a hired man, as if he were a sojourner. He shall serve you until the year of Jubilee. He shall then go out from you, he and his sons with him, and shall go back to his family. He may return to the property of his forefathers, for they are my servants whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They are not to be sold in a slave sale. You shall not rule over him with severity, but you are to revere your God. As for your male and female slaves whom you may have, you may acquire male and female slaves from the pagan nations that are around you. Then, too, it is out of the sons of the sojourners who live as aliens among you that you may gain acquisition, and out of their families who are with you, whom they will have produced in your land, they also may become your possession. You may even bequeath them to your sons after you to receive as a possession. You can use them as permanent slaves, but in respect to your countrymen, the sons of Israel, you shall not rule with severity over one another. Now if the means of a stranger or of a sojourner with you becomes sufficient, and a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to him as to sell himself to a stranger who is sojourning with you, or to the descendants of a stranger's family, then he shall have redemption right after he has been sold. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle's son may redeem him, or one of his blood relatives from his family may redeem him, or if he prospers, he may redeem himself. He then, with his purchaser, shall calculate from the year which he sold himself up to the year of Jubilee, and the price of his sale shall correspond to the number of years, if like the days of a hired man that he shall be with him. If there are still many years, he shall refund part of his purchase price in proportion to them for his own redemption. And if few years remain until the year of Jubilee, he shall so calculate with him. In proportion to his years, he is to refund the amount for his redemption. Like a man hired year by year, he shall be with him. He shall not rule over him with severity in your sight. Even if he is not redeemed by these means, he shall still go out in the year of Jubilee, he and his sons with him. For the sons of Israel are my servants. They are my servants whom I brought out from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So this section just explains how a poor Israelite could be sold to another individual and remain as a hired workman until the year of Jubilee. The idea of that someone gets himself into such extreme debt that he has sold everything he has and he still owes, the only thing he has left to sell is himself, his ability to labor, so that's what he sells. But God makes the point that all he's selling is his ability to labor. He cannot sell himself. He is not to be treated as a slave. He's not to be treated the way the Israelites were treated in Egypt. And again, the theological foundation is built there in verse 42. The Israelites are God's servants. They are God's slaves. And if they're owned by God, they cannot be owned by another person. God bought them for himself when he redeemed them from Egypt. The only candidates for what we would think of as traditional slavery in Israel were those who were foreigners or temporary relatives. Those who came from pagan nations around them or those who were sojourners from other nations living within their midst. Those people, as much as because of our American heritage, we find slavery very much repulsive, those people, God says, they can be your slaves. You can own them as your slaves, but you cannot own an Israelite. He also makes it clear that there would be foreigners, sojourners, potentially living among them. And this foreigner could indenture an Israelite. The foreigner might be the one who has the upper hand, where the Israelite becomes indebted to a foreigner and sells himself to the foreigner, and that could happen. But yet, because it's within the land of Israel, special attention must be given to how the Israelite was treated. According to these verses here, 47 through around 53, he's to be treated as a hired man. That's a word for day labor. So the foreigners who are dwelling within the land of Israel had to live by Israel's laws, was the point. They are living there, so the laws that an Israelite could not be sold into permanent slavery applied to anyone who lived within the boundaries of Israel. So if an Israelite was purchased by a foreigner, it was up to the nation to make sure that he was treated as a hired man, not as a slave. Verses 48 and 49 also then tell us how this kinsman redeemer works. An Israelite who sold himself to an alien or to a temporary resident, to someone who was not an Israelite living in Israel, could be redeemed by a relative, or he could redeem himself. That was the law of the land. The foreigner had to abide by that law. So he could be redeemed by the same way as property, a kinsman redeemer, or by his own redemption, or by the year of Jubilee. Well, verses 48 and 49 tell us more about this kinsman redeemer. It spells out the actual sequence of the kinsman redeemer. It starts with his brother. He's the first kinsman redeemer. If he's not able, or there's not a brother, then it goes to an uncle, then to the first cousin, the uncle's son, or to any blood relative from his family. So it keeps spiraling out. Those who are closest, all the way out to any blood relative, has this obligation to fulfill the role of kinsman redeemer. If you remember the story of Ruth with Boaz, when he agrees to be Ruth's kinsman redeemer, he says, but there is another one closer than I. So he has to go meet with that one to make sure that that one's not going to exercise his obligation being a kinsman redeemer. And Boaz says, I'm in position ready to do it if you will not. Well, we get that sequence from these verses here, how that works, how the chain of kinsman's redeemer flows is based on the nearer relative has first right of redemption. And it is a right, it's an obligation that they had. When the redemption occurs, the price is based on, again, how soon the next Jubilee would occur. How many years of potential labor is being bought back through redemption? In verse 54 here it says, even if he is not redeemed by these means, again we're talking about an Israelite who's owned by a foreigner, this Israelite shall still go out in the year of Jubilee. In other words, he's free. And God uses here through Moses the very same verb in verse 42 as go out, as we have in verse 45 for brought out from the land of Egypt. He shall go out because you, we don't have good English for it, because you went out, you go out from Egypt under my authority. He uses that same verb to show that there's a connection here. The reason this Jubilee is in place is because of what God has done. And the connection is to show that God is the one who causes both redemptions. God causes the ultimate redemption of the year of Jubilee, when if all else fails, in that 50th year, God himself redeems the property, he redeems the person. God is the one who redeemed them originally from Egypt. Not only the land, but the Israelites themselves are God's possessions. So he has every right to dictate these laws. So he closes with, I am the Lord your God. So he can declare how the land is to take rest and how his people are to be emancipated. Now both the Jubilee, this looking forward to release, as well as the Sabbath, looking to rest, these are types that take on greater emphasis as we go through Scripture. These are types of rest and the types of release that are brought on by Christ himself. And they will find their fullest expression through Christ when the kingdom is established. We celebrate our table this evening. And part of our celebration that I mentioned is to look forward to that time when Christ will return, and then we will have our Sabbath rest. It will be the year of our Jubilee when we are freed and we are in his presence. In Isaiah verse 61, or in Isaiah chapter 61, verse 1 through 3, we read, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and freedom to prisoners, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant those who mourn in Zion, giving them a garland instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the mantle of praise instead of a spirit of fainting, so they will be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified." When that first verse there, where it says that he has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted and to proclaim liberty to the captives, that word of liberty is the very same word that's used in our chapter in verse 10 here for the word release. This year of Jubilee, when release is proclaimed. So the Jews long recognized that Isaiah 61 was talking about the ultimate year of Jubilee that God would bring, the ultimate release that would come through the Messiah. It's interesting that this is exactly the passage that our Lord read in Luke chapter 4, verses 18 and 19 that we have in Luke 4 when he picked up a scroll in the temple and he turned to Isaiah and he read the first verse and part of the second verse. He read that the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and freedom to prisoners, to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. And then he stopped and handed back the scroll because that was the part that he was fulfilling in his first coming. Our Lord is beginning the process of Jubilee. We look forward to him completing that process when he comes. Any questions? As every evening, I give you the chance here for questions. All right. Well, tonight there are none, so we will go to a final song. I have Pastor Ben and Jerry come and lead us in a song and then close us in prayer tonight.